From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, a comedy juggling duo who've got shows this weekend in Grass Valley. Also, a Reno author whose new novel is a love story set in part in Sacramento. But first, Argentine artist Claudia Bernardi. His personal experience of life under a dictatorship, a military coup in 1976, overthrew Argentina's government. Tens of thousands of people disappeared over the next 7 years. Bernardi left for the U.S. in 1979. She now splits the time between California and El Salvador and Argentina. In El Salvador, she teaches art at a school she founded. Her own work is marked by a strong interest in human rights and social justice. Claudia Bernardi is currently artist-in-residence at Sacramento High School. Meanwhile, there's an exhibit of her work at the nearby 40 Acres Art Gallery. She's in our studio. Claudia Bernardi, welcome to Inside.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
How did life in Argentina change after the military coup?
It changed profoundly, mainly because there was the arrival of a democratic government. And I would say the success of Argentina after the coup is that we have been able to sustain democracy. During the time of the dictatorship, it was a time that has been recorded as state terror, in which it means that all citizens were somehow suspected to be a threat for the appointed government.
Why did you leave Argentina? Were you being looked at by the authorities as a possible troublemaker?
That's an elastic question. I think it is fair to say that at the time many people chose to leave Argentina because it was unsafe. And my story, in a way, is a little more celebratory because I had options. I did choose to leave, and that was not possible for many people, especially people from my generation. I would say it is elastic because it is unfair to summarize something so complicated. But if you ask me, what I saw and what I perceive as danger was that, yes, that we as citizens of the country did not seem to have the rights to endorse our own voices or to have, you know, civilian human rights. We did not know, however, and this is important to recognize, I don't think we were able to measure the catastrophe of the impact of the military junta until the military junta ended and a new government, elected democratically, came to investigate the violations of human rights that had happened.
And your sister was involved in a group called the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team.
Correct.
Which was set up to look for victims of the junta.
Correct.
Could you tell us how that operated and how you got involved?
Well, first to say that she was, and she still is, my sister Patricia Bernardi is a member of the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team. In 1984, when the process of democracy was a little more robust, the new democratically elected president, Raúl Alfonsín, made his main mandate to investigate violations of human rights perpetrated by the military junta. With that as a main urgent consideration, a forensic anthropologist from this country, Dr. Clyde Snow, went to Argentina with the expectations of work with other scientists in this kind of investigation, but actually was arduous for him to find that cooperation. And he did find cooperation from a group of very young students of anthropology and medicine at first. He prepared this young group of scientists to become what they are now, a very well-known forensic anthropology team that travels all over the world. So the mandate in 1984 was to investigate, number one, if it was true that there had been clandestine centers of detention that produced the effect of very numerous executions extrajudicially that would concur with the assumption that there were mass graves created illegally. That was what the team investigation was about. They found many, they still are finding many massacres committed against civilians that resulted in the creation of mass graves where these bodies were deposited. So in 1984, their work was, and still is in Argentina and other parts of the world, to exhume the human remains, to investigate the cause of death, the age and sex of the human remains found at the mass grave, and if possible, to continue investigation about identification.
And what about your involvement?
My involvement came directly through being my sister's sister and through being aware at a level that perhaps other citizens at the time were not aware, just because of the contact, the close contact with the team's work, that what we had suspected only was a reality of an enormous caliber that affected all our generation. I think it is fair to say that the first impact was the connection of that information into my art, not with a willingness to create political art, but with the understanding that I was profoundly changed by this information.
You were an artist before this.
Yes, I was an artist before that. And then what did happen concretely in terms of connecting as a participant of the Argentine forensic team was when the war in El Salvador ended in 1992, the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team was nominated by the United Nations Truth Commission to investigate the case of the massacre at El Mozote that had occurred in 1981. My role in that investigation as part of the Argentine team was to produce the archaeological maps that records the different maps record the findings of the human remains, the location of the findings of ballistic evidence, and the finding of associated evidence.
And that was a turning point in your life.
It was indeed.
Why? What you had presumably come upon many dreadful things in your life and in your work. What was it about that experience in El Salvador that was so profound?
I think it's another elastic question, but I would imagine that is fair to say that one of the, for me personally, and I think it's true for the rest of the team, is that until that moment, we have never seen in a mass grave the presence of children. What the evidence of the forensic search was at the time was that the allegation of mass murder had been confirmed, that we had found 143 individuals, of whom 136 were children under the age of 12, with an average age of 6 years of age. It was a long process. We were at the site for over 2 months, literally finding day after day human remains of children. They were so small. They were so fragile. And I don't think I was prepared to deal with that over and over again.
My guest is the artist and art educator Claudia Bernardi. She's from Argentina. There's an exhibit of her work at 40 Acres in Sacramento through December 30th. She's also currently on a 3-month artist in residency at Sacramento High School. And tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, she is at the Guild Theater in Sacramento in conversation with Mark Danner, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He specializes in politics and foreign policy. And the title of the conversation will be What Happened at El Mozote, which is the place that we're just talking about in El Salvador. Mark Danner is well known earlier in his career for writing about the massacre at El Mozote, first for The New Yorker magazine, and then in a book called The Massacre at El Mozote. He joins us from Berkeley. Mark Danner, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Well, it's a book-length topic, but tell us in a shorter amount of time, I'm afraid, what did happen at El Mozote and why?
Well, at El Mozote, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 civilians were massacred over a period of a little more than a day by the Salvadoran army. They were buried in mass graves. This event was then denied both by the Salvadoran government and then by the American government as well, which at the time, of course, was the major supporter of the military government of El Salvador. It became a rather controversial subject in Washington because the Congress at the time, the Democratic Congress, during the early years of the Reagan administration, this was December 1981, had imposed conditions on the Reagan administration for supporting the Salvadoran junta. And one of those conditions was that the administration had to show to get additional aid for the Salvadorans that the Salvador government was improving in its respect for human rights. And this massacre came about 6 weeks before the first certification, as it was called, was due to come up in the Congress. Early on after the massacre happened, a couple of journalists, Raymond Bonner of the New York Times and Alma Guillermo Prieto of the Washington Post, along with the photographer Susan Micellus, were able at great risk to themselves to get to what remained of the village of El Mazote and the several surrounding hamlets where the massacre had taken place. And they documented it, publishing pieces on the front pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times, and also Susan's extraordinary photographs. Nonetheless, the American government denied this had taken place. The aid was indeed certified, and support for the Salvadoran government continued. The question of what exactly happened there and why is a difficult one. And as you say, it's a book-length or longer subject. But one can say that the Salvadoran government at the time, the Salvadoran army, was using a kind of scorched earth strategy in those parts of the country that were largely controlled by the FMLN rebels. And Morazan province, where El Mazote is located, was thought of as one of these red zones. One of the interesting things, I think, is that the El Mazote itself was not thought to be overly sympathetic to the FMLN. In fact, there's some evidence that when the army came, while other villagers fled, surrounding villagers, and actually left the area, those in El Mazote stayed in part because they believed that they ran no risk from the army, that is, the army would understand that they weren't supporters of the rebels and would leave them alone. In the event, the soldiers essentially herded them first out into the village square, and then into several houses, and then methodically killed them, the men first, then the children, and then the women. And there were very few survivors of this event. One of them, really the sole adult survivor from El Mazote itself, was named Rufina Amaya, who managed, as she was lined up, waiting to be killed, to escape and hide under a tree or behind a tree. And she heard the massacre, almost all of it happened. She heard her children screaming. She lost four small children to the soldiers that day. And essentially, in the years since, became the storyteller of what had happened, the recounter.
I can't imagine what that must have been like for her to carry this around for the rest of her life.
Well, she told me in a long and very painful interview when I wrote this story that, you know, as she heard the little children calling, she dug a little hole in the ground to put her face in so she could weep and scream. Because, of course, if she had revealed herself, she also would have been killed. And she said that she told herself then, and she told God then, that if he allowed her to survive, she would consider that it was her mission to tell this story and to make it known. And she indeed devoted a lot of her life to telling this story clearly to anyone who would listen, including giving me many hours of her time. And it's worth saying that she died only a few months ago, very much before her time. She leaves a daughter who's training to be a doctor, Martita. But Rufina, I'm very sorry to say, is no longer with us. But I came to this story in 92 when the Argentine forensic team was hard at work exhuming this site. And I remember very vividly the site itself, the extraction of these small bundles, which was what was left of the 136 children that Claudia described a moment ago. and remembered meeting Claudia there, of course, because she was standing over the site and carefully drawing the disposition of the bodies in what seemed to be a chaotic site. And she made a series of very haunting drawings that charted not only the disposition of the bodies, but the layers of the disposition of the bodies down to the floor of the crypt of the church, in which she did a drawing that actually charted the bullet holes where the slugs were found in the floor, which really constituted not only a record, a valuable record, but also the final definitive proof that this was a massacre and not in some way a battle, as the government had claimed at various times, that in fact troops had stood around the church and had fired in fired their weapons into the pile of bodies to make sure everyone was dead. And some of these shells had, as I remember it, Leavenworth canvas stamped on them, because of course they had been supplied by the American government. Mm-hmm. So that process of recording was not only recording for history, but giving a definitive end to any controversy about what in fact had happened at El Masote. Immensely valuable thing to do, needless to say.
Journalist and author Mark Danner. His works include the book The Massacre at El Masote. Claudia Bernardi, the exhibit of your work at 40 Acres includes works that have been inspired by your experiences at El Masote. Could you tell us how what you experienced there has shown up in your work?
Since El Masote, the line of inspiration seems to continue bringing me back to what we saw, what we heard. But I think fortunately, not only in terms of the catastrophe of this violence, but also, as Mark pointed out, the tenacity of Rufina that was capable and willing to go over what happened at El Masote as much and as frequent as needed. So for me, when I remember El Masote, it's an epic event where all the characters of the human capacity seem to coexist, both the terrible ones and also the ones that give me hope. The process in which I work, which is pigments of paper, have the possibility of creating an artwork that has many, many different layers. And I think for me that is beneficial in terms of the choice of technique, because it goes through many processes, many transformations.
People can see a few images from the Claudia Bernardi exhibit on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. And one of the images, I think, the English title, Life Draws a Tree and Death Draws Another One, is an example of what you're talking about. Could you tell us what these pigments are that you're working with?
These are pure pigments. They do not have any binder, which means that it's a little more arduous to have the pigments become part of the paper. It involves a printmaking process in which the pigment is applied to wet paper, but for a long time the piece needs time, and I think the concept of the time at the exhumation was also crucial. The fact that, well, the name of the show at 40 Acres is The Silent Was Hostile and Almost Perfect, and that to me resumes a lot of what my first sentiments were about the site, something that evidently was hostile but contained information that was going to be revealed.
There seem to be few, if any, hard margins in these works of art. Why is that? Is that a function of working with these pigments? Is it deliberate?
Margins.
Well, hard edges around the shapes that are in the pictures.
I think it's an artist's choice, meaning nothing is very secure. And I think for the viewer, it would be advisable to spend some time, because the images reveal themselves not by presentation of, evidence of colors and shapes that are very distinct. They seem to emerge. That's the intention of the artist, that, mm-hmm. The images will come forward through a process of patients, perhaps.
Another work of yours, and there's the photograph at capradio.org/insight that people can look at right now if they wish. This is a photograph of part of it. It's called Murmullos. Could you tell us what we're looking at and why you made it that way?
You're looking at an installation called Murmullos, which translates as whispers. This piece was created in adjacency to a number of cultural and recordation events to remember the 25 years of the massacre at El Mozote. This piece was created initially for the Museum of Words in El Salvador. The piece contains a number of sculpture elements that are dresses that are implying being inhabited.
But they're empty when we look at them. They seem to be floating in the air with no body inside them.
Exactly. They are empty, but they imply presence. They are treated with paraffin. And they do have the sentiment of being a community, people that could have lived. What the viewer experiences is the presence of two sound sculptures that are sculptures taken from Morazán, Eperquín, El Salvador, and also El Mozote. These sounds evoke the life of Morazán, and there is another sound sculpture, which is probably the most provocative of the piece, in which the sounds collected are the voices of the children of Perquín and El Mozote today, reciting the voices of the dead children of El Mozote.
Now, Perquín is where your School of Art Open Studio that you founded a couple of years ago is based.
Correct.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there are some works from your young students at that school that are also displayed at 40 Acres right now. We have a few of those on our webpage too. And they're rather beautiful pieces.
Those are the best in the exhibition.
Yes.
Yes, it's very beautiful, but also it's very beautiful in the context of what we are talking about, the fact that we have today children working in art, concerned about issues of beauty and community and collaboration through art, where, you know, we have a very recent history that was so very brutal. It's a success, and all the credit to the community, of course.
Do you specifically try and encourage the children to deal with the massacre at El Mozote in their art at the school?
No, we don't work like that. We do work always in community-based and collaborative projects. For instance, the one element that it was clear we needed to address was when we were remembering the 25 years anniversary, how would the children be part of that? And fortunately, there was such a gap to make them understand the enormity of the massacre. But they are only too aware because their family members know about it. You know, they grow up knowing about it. The way we created this collaborative project in which they chose a name of a dead child to recite them publicly was a poetic way to make the liaison between the dead children and the children of today.
Mark Danner, author of The Massacre at El Mozote. I guess you're familiar with Claudia's artworks?
Yes, of course.
Yes. How do you respond to her works inspired by The Massacre at El Mozote?
Well, I think that's what Claudia called a moment ago an elastic question, which I gather that means that it can expand. The answer can expand indefinitely. I think her work is astonishing, and I have one of her paintings that I'm looking at right now. One of her works, which is on the wall in front of me in my house in California, called "The Little Orange Horse," which was, I guess, inspired or at least takes off from a moment during the exhumation when one of the members of the Argentine forensic team found in one of these bundles of bones that were the remains of these children a tiny little orange plastic horse that had been a little play toy for the child. And she held it up, and you suddenly saw the whole life of a child in front of you and the life that was there and that had been cut short in this way, the life that was never lived. And this work not only commemorates that, but expands on it. And It's extremely powerful, as so many of her works are. I think they're remarkable, extraordinary paintings. I think the important point to make here is not only that people should go see the work, absolutely go see the work, but to me it's about not simply a horrible event, and not simply the lives that were cut short by this horrible event, but by the life that has continued. And, Claudia has spent her life not only commemorating some of these things in her art, but engaging her life with the community of El Masote, going back, working with the children, giving something to them that's mm-hmm. very separate from this period of violence itself. It's about redemption, it's about learning, it's about engaging their spirit through works of art. And all of that kind of spirit, it seems to me, is present very much in the work as well.
Yes.
So that means a lot to me, because I spend a lot of my life writing about war and about violence. And, you know, the United States, it's very odd, as Americans, you know, we have this strange knowledge, if we're interested in foreign affairs, we have this odd knowledge of parts of the world like Salvador, like Nicaragua, like Vietnam, that the spotlight of our attention shines brightly on these places for a few years. We create ruins there in one way or another, and then the spotlight moves on, you know, and you find 20 years later, well, we know a little bit about Salvador, we know a little bit of Nicaragua, we know a little bit of Vietnam, but Claudia's work stays. It represents a kind of attachment to a place and its people that I think is so lacking in mm-hmm. the American political culture. To me, that's what's one of the things most valuable about it.
Yes.
And I hope people go and see.
Well, that's Mark Danner. He and my studio guest, Claudia Bernardi, are in conversation tomorrow at the Guild Theater in Oak Park in Sacramento. It starts at 2 o'clock. It's a conversation called What Happened at El Masote. And in the meantime, Claudia Bernardi's exhibit, an exhibit of her works, many of her works over the last 25 years, is on display at the nearby 40 Acres Art Gallery. And Claudia is a three-month artist in residency at Sacramento High School. Claudia, Mark, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Earlier in the show, we talked about visual arts. Time now for another radio-friendly topic, juggling. The Raspini Brothers, a comedy juggling act, has two shows this weekend in Grass Valley at the Center for the Arts. They performed internationally, appeared on both the Johnny Carson and Jay Leno versions of The Tonight Show, and opened for big names like Robin Williams, Billy Crystal, and Dennis Miller. They've also had some unusual legal experience, but we'll get to that later. In the meantime, let's welcome the two Raspini brothers, who are not really brothers, Barry Friedman and Dan Holzman. Barry, Dan, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All those credits, and now Insight.
Yes.
It finally comes around.
Have you done juggling on radio?
We did once in Edinburgh, Scotland.
Oh, yes?
That's right. We had a big audience, and yeah. It was funny. We held up signs to cue the audience.
So was that during the big festival?
Yeah.
Yeah, a few years back.
I see.
The Fringe Festival, we were there.
It was, unfortunately, that the juggling didn't go over too big there, because there's lots of jugglers on the streets.
Yes.
So you're competing with the free shows outside. So it's hard to bring them into the theater to see juggling in the theater.
Well, Barry, that's Dan Holzman, mm-hmm. Barry Friedman.
Yes.
What do you guys do that's different, that distinguishes you from the jugglers on the street?
Oh, well, we do a lot of, the venues we work in help separate us. We tend to spend most of our years running around the country performing at large corporate sales events and product launches and things that pay very well, as opposed to change on the street. So that's where we like to focus our main difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've the Raspini brothers have been around since 1982. Does that mean the two of you have been working together for, what, 25 years?
Yeah, going on our 26th year.
Well, you don't look, look like it.
Well, that's nice. We started at four. No, yeah. We started at 20. So you know, do the math there. It's gone fast when you're having a lot of fun.
It wasn't meant to be a long-term thing. It was supposed to be a one-summer gig, and then it just kind of snowballed.
We thought we'd cling together like two pair of underwear in a dryer without cling-free.
So it'd just be temporary, but it was split apart.
I got it in.
Oh, you did?
I wanted to say underwear during this interview. I don't know why.
What did you start juggling with, Dan? What were the first objects you juggled with?
I actually started with green oranges. There was a book in 1974 called The Juggling Book by Carlo. And it was the first sort of mass-produced juggling instructional book that came out in the bookstores. And I grew up in California in Los Angeles, and we had orange trees. And the green ones lasted longer than the orange ones. So I'd take the unripe green oranges in the backyard, and those were my first props. In fact, when I went to my first juggling meeting, my only props were three green oranges. And that was, as you can imagine, not really quite an extensive display of props.
You didn't show well.
No, no. It's like, look at me, I got oranges, look at me.
And Barry, what did you start with?
I think I started with something similar. Dan and I got into juggling unusual items very early in our performing. We got away from the balls and clubs and rings, and we tend to do things with blowguns and bullwhips and ping pong ball juggling in my mouth, which I brought so we could demonstrate for the folks today. So.
Well, we do have a special microphone set up in the studio so we can perhaps hear a little bit of what you're doing. Tell us the first thing you'd like to do, Barry.
I think I'll do a little bit of ping pong ball juggling in my mouth.
And,
we'll certainly.
So there's like two kinds of jugglers. There's the ones who rely on their incredible skills, like the juggler in Cusa, who I saw last night, Anthony Gatto.
Cirque du Soleil.
Cirque du Soleil. And there's others who decided that juggling by itself is not that entertaining, so they try to make it more unusual. And so what Barry's going to do is he's going to juggle ping pong balls by spitting them up into the air and catching them back in his mouth.
And just so people know what he's doing right now, they're sitting in a Tupperware container.
Yeah, that's full of saliva. It's half saliva, half Purell. Yes. So it sanitizes and cauterizes. And now he's spitting them up and catching them again with his mouth. So then you can hear that pa, pa, pa sound. And you can bet his parents are very proud.
That is amazing.
Two
ping pong balls.
Oh. Yeah.
And basically one is up in the air and the other one is in his mouth. And then he spits the second one up.
That's a world's record.
Yes.
For Barry, yeah. Other people do more.
No, for in the show I'll do more than that. But here in the studio.
For sitting down in the studio.
I'll do three in the live show. And it goes fast.
It's sitting down in the studio is good.
How do you breathe when you're doing ping pong?
It's a type of circular breathing, really. You do breathe through your nose, and this the air projects the balls up into the air. I got into this particular type of juggling because I saw it in Europe. We were visiting Europe when we were like 24. We got invited over to perform for the King of Spain from a Renaissance festival to that gig. So we didn't really know how to appropriately price it. So we got over there, and we went to Paris afterwards and saw some jugglers at the Lido de Paris, and there were these Czechoslovakian jugglers.
The Furcos.
Furcos. They invited us out.
Can you see that in the radio?
Furcos,
The Furcos. Yeah. Okay. On Insight, you
not
can.
Not in Czechoslovakia.
No, not in Czechoslovakia. But he was doing ping pong balls, and it was so inspirational. So I started playing with that, and the first time I did it, my parents got so mad at me. So that was good inspiration to keep going.
And why are they in water? In this Tupperware container.
Yeah, it makes them easier to go in and out of your mouth as opposed to being dry. And it keeps them clean. I have phobias, Jeffrey, you wouldn't even begin to understand. It's horrible.
Well, my guests are the Raspini brothers. They're comedy jugglers. They're at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley the Saturday and Sunday evenings. Barry Friedman just juggled with ping pong balls with his mouth. Dan, what do you do?
Well, I do these cups, and these are traditional shaker cups like you'd find in a bar, exactly the same, except the size, shape, and weight has been changed.
But for juggling.
For juggling. And I brought this because they actually do make a noise.
Yes.
And these are also called nested cups.
There you go. Look at these cups. They actually flips them and tumbles them through the air, catching them back nested.
My goodness.
Isn't that something? He can't read or write, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Isn't that amazing?
Dan, how challenging is that to do?
It's challenging because there's very few people who have done them, so there's not a lot to learn from. You have to make up a lot of your own tricks. And I did hold the Guinness World Record. It's never been beaten for doing eight in the air at the same time. In the shows, I only go for six because it takes me quite a few tries to get the eight. But I did hold the world's record since like 88 or something.
Yeah, I think it was in the 80s, yeah.
What would you do if it just you couldn't do it on stage and it just they just kept collapsing to the ground?
That's why I stopped doing eight. Yeah. Because there was a show we did at a comedy club.
It was in Indiana somewhere.
And I kept trying and trying and trying. I'm like, come out to the parking lot afterwards. I'll get it. I just wouldn't give up. I actually went to the parking lot after the show.
It was so funny.
But we had to move on at a certain point.
How do you know when to quit in a situation like
that? I didn't.
You didn't?
That was the problem. I must have tried it 12, 13, 14 tries.
But doing a comedy show, keeps snowballing, and it's very fun. It's not like there's any pressure on a band leader waiting to get on to the next measure of his vamp.
If it was a TV show or something, it might have been different. But, you know, live theater, even failure can be entertaining. That's our motto.
Indeed. Now, you got some other things here.
Yeah, here's another different one. Actually, maybe you do this one sitting down, maybe. I'll just do it like this.
Oh, these are tennis balls.
Yeah, these are tennis balls, and this is a regular tennis ball can.
I'm not going to use the can. I'll use the three balls. It's a combination of magic and juggling.
He actually levitates. He's got a pipe-looking thing in his mouth with a ball floating on top, and actually hovers a ball about an inch above his nose.
Catches the hovering...
It's not a showstopper, but it slows it down.
It really does. Yeah.
And is that a ping pong ball?
This is actually a special floating ball. It's even lighter than a ping pong ball.
Yes.
And this is funny. This is actually a commercially made game. It's a pipe and a tube, and the stream of air makes the ball levitate.
Okay.
I think this might be a first for Jeffrey.
Yeah. Now, what Barry's going to do, we like to use a lot of audience involvement. So he's going to do a spinning top and then spin it on the top of your head. If you feel a burning sensation, that means it's working.
So
you can hear the top. That's the spinning of the top.
Well, look, I'm actually going to put it on Jeffrey's hair, head.
Yeah.
Look at this.
Whoa.
It's spinning on my head at this moment.
Yeah.
It's spinning on his head on the radio. Yeah.
Stay perfectly still.
I'm going to remove it because it starts to burn after a minute.
There. Yeah, it
will leave a mark, so you'll remember that for a long time.
Yeah, it was starting to feel a little strange.
You're happy it's
strange
off.
In a good way or funny strange?
Yeah,
or,
it's weird. It hurts, but like 20 minutes later, you want it again.
It's like, yeah, it's like kind of a strange Chinese food. Yeah.
How do you expand the idea of juggling? You started out with simple objects, but how quickly did you get to the point of saying, you know, I've got to do something different?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the length of the show we do. Like most jugglers, what they call flash acts or music acts, do about 8 minutes. And they can specialize in a single prop for 8 minutes. Sometimes they use a variety, but some of them just specialize in one item. And they'll do that one act for their whole career. But in 60 minutes, you want to have a lot of variety. So maybe every 5 or 6 minutes you change props. So that's at least 10 different types of juggling in a 60-minute show.
Yeah, so we like to look at everyday objects, though, and think, how can we change them? How can we do something unexpected with them? We use golf clubs and blowguns and
paddle balls and toys. And
fire? People love to see fire.
We'll be doing fire very rarely, but we'll be doing it.
I think in Grass Valley we're going to light some things up because it's a small town, and you know, if we heard anything, it really is only in small newspapers.
Well, that leads me to a question about when jugglers use fire, because if you mess up with tennis balls or ping pong balls or these metal cans, so what? But if you mess up with fire, that could be horrible.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not horribly painful because you let go pretty quickly. You know, if you catch the wrong end, you're like, oh, I caught the wrong end. Oh, I caught the wrong end. I should let go. No, it happens much quicker than that. Yeah. But I have seen people set things on fire, like curtains.
Oh, yeah. Set off sprinkler systems in hotel rooms. Mm.
And one time I hit a dog one time. We were doing a Renaissance fair, and someone had a beautiful
white husky type.
Yeah, I think it was a white Irish setter, if there is such a thing.
But you covered it brilliantly.
Yeah.
He yelled,
hot dog, or something like that.
And that was it, and then we moved on.
I go, how much is that dog worth? $5,000. Not anymore. You know, that kind of thing.
Help people through the grief.
When I introduced you, I said that in your professional experience, you've had some unusual legal experience, and I'm referring to the sequestered O.J. Simpson jury. Yeah. You performed for them. How did that come about?
We did. We read in the newspaper that they were bringing in acts and types of entertainment. We heard that they brought in Mr. Blackwell to do a sort of a fashion review, and we thought, my gosh, if he could do it. So it was literally not much more than calling Judge Lance Ito. There's a name that's getting less and less airplay. So
we actually called Judge Ito.
Yeah,
he had to okay it. Yeah, we went through his office and he had to okay it.
Yeah, and it was great, and we got okay for it. But it was incredible, Jeffrey. They put us in this room with all these envelopes marked confidential. No instruction to not say anything. No instruction of what to stay away from, or no supervision. And we're just in the courtroom with 12 jurors, basically. I think we could have thrown the whole thing.
They had no idea who we are, what we were going to do. It was just like, well, you want to do it for free? You're going to entertain these people? Go ahead. And I had a lot of definite views on the trial and the guilt or innocence of O.J. Simpson. And I did consider, you know, saying something perhaps, but I thought better of it.
What was your impression of the jury? Did you have much contact with them?
Sure. Well, we got to see them. And one guy tried to heckle us in the middle of our hour-long set for 12 people that didn't understand jokes. And it was really difficult for him to even form a sentence. It was really scary.
Yeah. I always say they lost the case in jury selection.
After we met them.
Yeah, because I think my philosophy or my feeling was that they do the Rodney King verdict earlier, that they tried to load the jury with a certain segment of the population so that when they found him guilty, there wouldn't be riots.
It wasn't a whole bunch of very intellectual lawyer-type
people.
Well, it
wasn't
that.
It was sort of done by racial lines because they wanted to be predominantly African-American, my belief was, so that when they found him guilty, there wouldn't be a riot. So it wouldn't be like a white jury finding him guilty.
Huh.
Yeah.
And I know maybe that's a little too over the top, but that's...
We were in there. No one had seen him, though, when we were in this room with him, and it was just really interesting to get that piece.
I just felt they thought he was so guilty, and there was so much evidence that it was sort of a slam dunk. And so that's how they wanted to play it. That was just my take on it.
Finally, you've done The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and Jay Leno. Which was the better experience?
Oh, Johnny Carson. Yeah,
Why?
Oh, Jay Leno is a huge fan of Jay Leno, and it's hard to get any jokes in when you're on with Jay Leno.
Whereas Johnny stands back
and says, you guys, this is your eight minutes to play and do it.
He comes from a magic background, and he was a professional magician before a talk show host. And with him, it was like you did your spot, and he helped you. Like, we used him as a volunteer. In Jay Leno, it's like Jay Leno does his spot, and you help him to sort of sell a joke or to be in a skit.
Yeah.
So the priorities were a little different.
Right. Mm. Well, I'll try and learn from that personally.
Well, we're learning from you. We've been listening to your show for so long and had no idea you did your show wearing just a thong and a helmet.
Can I request Bruce Springsteen's new song? It's quite good.
It's two for Friday.
Barry Friedman and Dan Holzman are the Raspini brothers. They're a pair of comedy jugglers. They perform at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley the Saturday and Sunday evenings. Raspini brothers, thank you both very much for joining us on Insight.
Jeffrey, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, Reno author Rini Reit. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Imagine a love story with 9/11 as its backdrop. Chances are you picture it unfolding in New York or the Middle East. Well, a new novel with just that theme is actually set in part in Sacramento. The main character is the California Attorney General. Not Jerry Brown, though. It's a fictional AG called Kyle Anderson. The author of this book, called Pilgrim Souls, lives in Reno. She's Rini Reit. Rini, welcome to Insight.
It's so good to be on, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to set your book, at least in part, in Sacramento?
Well, in deciding to unfold the 9/11 story, California was the destination of all the airplanes. So I decided to I wanted my hero to be a strong, powerful man, and I selected the Attorney General of California, and it does sound very similar to Jerry Brown, but it truly, truly is not Jerry Brown. But he is a strong Catholic and very involved in peace issues. And I selected him because his brother works in Washington, D.C., in the Secretary of State's office, and it gives me the opportunity to create that dialogue between what's going on in Washington, really what's going on in Washington, with the fictional character who's having struggles with the woman he loves.
And what was your goal in writing this book? Because you have, as far as I can tell, a more serious purpose than simply writing a love story.
I absolutely do. I want to encourage people to really be people of peace. So the story has a very strong message that whether it's a couple who are in love but unable to overcome their impasse, or whether it's a family with problems within the family, or whether it's America having problems with the Middle East, I really want to get across the story that the resolution to the conflict is the same. It's exactly the same, no matter how small or how big the issue. There will never, ever be peace unless somebody gives. Mm-hmm. Because it's so easy to think, innocent. I am the victim here, and the other side is the evil monster. And as long as we hold that position and never, ever, ever try to cross over to figure out what is the other side feeling, why is this person so angry at me that he's willing to leave me? Or why is this other country so angry at us that they are willing to commit suicide to get their point across and to get revenge with us? And so the story is about looking into the other side.
Well, your questions, your rhetorical questions sound quite reasonable, but based on the actions of governments, not just here or this time, but throughout the millennia, it doesn't seem like those questions are raised so often in centers of power.
Well, because it's all about a power struggle. I think whenever there's a power struggle going on, it's so easy to get locked into my own mindset of what it is I want to accomplish here. But if we want to reach some kind of resolution, we've got to start figuring out, why is the other side objecting to my point of view? What is it that's going on inside of their head? And is there anything I've done to create that concern or that that resistance to going along with me? And if I can do that, if I could just get my head into the other side, and this book is a book about getting our heads into the other side, both between the couple and with America and the Middle East.
My guest is Renee Reed. She's author of Pilgrim Souls, A Search for Peace Amidst Conflict. It's a novel. It's a love story with 9/11 as its backdrop, and the protagonist is a fictional California attorney general. Renee, you've had a fairly long and diverse career. You had a successful career as a business person, and you also were an elected official for a while in Reno. But earlier in your life, you were a Catholic nun for a while, and earlier you mentioned that the protagonist in your book is a strong Catholic. I guess that is still an important part of your life.
Very important part of my life. It certainly laid a foundation for probably my beliefs today. I am so convinced that this war is senseless and that there is a solution to it. But as what I actually did is, with my mindset, I interviewed or researched about a dozen global experts on peace, international peace. And, you know, I couldn't help but notice it, Jeffrey, that every time I saw what their solutions were, it fits for everyone. It fits for the couple, it fits for the family, it fits for communities, it fits for our global problems. For example, Francis Fukuyama was formerly a deputy secretary of state and one of the neoconservatives in government, and he had a conversion. But, you know, he just points out that that we've got to start looking inside other countries, not just at their external behavior. And he suggests that in order to build trust with them, we've got to create whole new institutions in order to be able to. We can't just rely on America being the unilateral decider for the world, but we need to create some new institutions that help us resolve the world situations.
Such as, we don't have much time, but give us a quick example.
He wants to see us come together. So instead of one person, the President of the United States, deciding what is best for the world, what kind of democracy they should have, he recommends that we go outside of our tradition and we create institutions, world institutions, that would help formulate real democracy that's appropriate to the culture of that country. And we have the chance to do that. Another example is there's a bill before Congress right now for creating a Department of Peace that would exist alongside the Department of Defense. And this is real. I didn't make this up. This is a real bill. And I very much think that if we had an administration in Washington that would think peace before mm-hmm. they think military. It doesn't all have to be
yes.
about hard power.
And we'll have to wrap it up there. Renee Reed is author of Pilgrim Souls, A Search for Peace Amidst Conflict. It's a novel. And she has a book signing tomorrow at the Barnes & Noble at Birdcage Walk in Citrus Heights. And you can find more information about all that and all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. Renee Reed, thank you so much for joining us.
Jeffrey, it was great being on your show. Thanks.
Bye-bye. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's theme is composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. Thanks for technical assistance today to Philip Ball. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us.